20. One day in the life of a reader of the New York Times. The New York Times can plausibly be regarded as the world's leading newspaper. It is an indispensable source of news and commentary, but there is a lot more that one can learn by reading it carefully and critically. Let us keep to a single day, April 6th, 2015. Though almost any other day would have provided similar insights into prevailing ideology and intellectual culture. A front-page article is devoted to a flawed story about a campus rape in Rolling Stone magazine, exposed in the Columbia Journalism Review. So severe is this departure from journalistic integrity that it is also the subject of the lead story in the business section, with a full inside page devoted to the continuation of the two reports. The shocked reports refer to several past crimes of the press, a few cases of fabrication quickly exposed, and cases of plagiarism, too numerous to list. The specific crime of Rolling Stone is lack of skepticism, which is, in many ways, the most insidious of the three categories. It is refreshing to see the commitment of the Times to the integrity of journalism. On page 7 of the same issue, there is an important story by Thomas Fuller headlined, "One Woman's Mission to Free Laos from Millions of Unexploded Bombs." It reports on the single-minded effort of a Lao-American woman, Chanapa Kamvongsa, to rid her native land of millions of bombs still buried there, the legacy of a 9-year American air campaign that made Laos one of the most heavily bombed places on Earth. The story notes that as a result of Ms. Kamvongsa's lobbying, the United States increased its annual spending on the removal of unexploded bombs by a munificent $12 million. The most lethal are cluster bombs, which are designed to cause maximum casualties to troops by spraying hundreds of bomblets onto the ground. About 30% remain unexploded, so that they kill and maim children who pick up the pieces, farmers who strike them while working, and other unfortunates. An accompanying map features Chiang Kuang Province in northern Laos, better known as the Plain of Jars, the primary target of the intensive bombing, which reached its peak of fury in 1969. Fuller reports that Miss Kamvongsa was spurred into action when she came across a collection of drawings of the bombings made by refugees and collected by Fred Bamfman, an anti-war activist who helped expose the secret war. The drawings appear in his remarkable book, Voices from the Plain of Jars, published in 1972 and republished by the University of Wisconsin Press in 2013 with a new introduction. The drawings vividly display the torment of the victims, poor peasants in a remote area that had virtually nothing to do with the Vietnam War, as officially conceded. One typical report by a 26-year-old nurse captures the nature of the air war. "There wasn't a night when we'd thought we'd live until morning. Never a morning we thought we'd survive until night. Did our children cry? Oh yes, and we did also. I just stayed in my cave. I didn't see the sunlight for 2 years. What did I think about? Oh, I used to repeat, 'Please don't let the planes come. Please don't let the planes come. Please don't let the planes come.'" Branfman's valiant efforts did indeed bring some awareness of this hideous atrocity. His assiduous research also unearthed the reasons for the savage destruction of a helpless peasant society. He exposed them once again in the introduction to the new edition of Voices. One of the most shattering revelations about the bombing was discovering why it had so vastly increased in 1969, as described by the refugees. I learned that after President Lyndon Johnson had declared a bombing halt over North Vietnam in November 1968, he had simply diverted the planes into northern Laos. There was no military reason for doing so. It was simply because, as U.S. Deputy Chief of Mission Monteagle Stearns testified to the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations in October 1969, "Well, we had all those planes sitting around, and couldn't just let them stay there with nothing to do. Therefore, the unused planes were unleashed on poor peasants, devastating the peaceful Plain of Jars, far from the ravages of Washington's murderous wars of aggression in Indochina. Let us now see how these revelations are transmuted into New York Times Newspeak. Writes Fuller, "The targets were North Vietnamese troops, especially along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, a large part of which passed through Laos, as well as North Vietnam's Laotian communist allies." Compare this to the words of the U.S. Deputy Chief of Mission and the heartrending drawings and testimony in Fred Bamfman's book. True, the Times reporter has a source, U.S. propaganda. That surely suffices to overwhelm mere facts about one of the major crimes of the post-World War II era, as detailed in the very source he cites, Fred Bamfman's Crucial Revelations. We can be confident that this colossal lie in the service of the state will not merit lengthy exposure and denunciation of disgraceful misdeeds of the free press, such as plagiarism and lack of skepticism. The same issue of the New York Times treats us to a report by the inimitable Thomas Friedman, earnestly relaying the words of President Obama, presenting what Friedman labels the Obama Doctrine. Every president has to have a doctrine. The profound doctrine is engagement combined with meeting core strategic needs. The president illustrated his doctrine with a crucial case. You take a country like Cuba. For us to test the possibility that engagement leads to a better outcome for the Cuban people, there aren't that many risks for us. It's a tiny little country. It's not one that threatens our core security interests. And so there's no reason not to test the proposition. And if it turns out that it doesn't lead to better outcomes, we can adjust our policies. Here, the Nobel Peace Laureate expands on his reasons for undertaking what the leading left liberal intellectual journal, the New York Review of Books, hails as the brave and truly historic step of reestablishing diplomatic relations with Cuba. It is a move undertaken in order to more effectively empower the Cuban people, the hero explained, our earlier efforts to bring them freedom and democracy having failed to achieve our noble goals. Searching further, we find other gems. There is, for example, a front-page think piece on the Iran nuclear deal by Peter Baker, published a few days earlier, warning about the Iranian crimes regularly listed by Washington's propaganda system. All proved to be quite revealing on analysis, though none more so than the ultimate Iranian crime, destabilizing the region by supporting Shiite militias that killed American soldiers in Iraq. Here again is the standard picture, when the United States invades Iraq, virtually destroying it and inciting sectarian conflicts that are tearing the country and now the whole region apart, that counts as stabilization in official and hence media rhetoric. When Iran supports militias resisting the aggression, that is destabilization. And there could hardly be a more heinous crime than killing American soldiers attacking one's home. All of this, and far, far more, makes perfect sense if we show due obedience and uncritically accept approved doctrine. The United States owns the world, and it does so by right, for reasons also explained lucidly in the New York Review of Books, in a March 2015 article by Jessica Matthews, former president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. American contributions to international security, global economic growth, freedom, and human well-being have been so self-evidently unique and have been so clearly directed to others' benefit that Americans have long believed that the U.S. amounts to a different kind of country. Where others push their national interests, the U.S. tries to advance universal principles. The defense rests.